So, once upon a time, there was this man, and he was in search of meaning. And so he sold all his possessions, and he left his family, and he went on a journey to find himself. And he traveled the world, and he asked questions of everyone he met. What is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of life? What is life for? And he couldn't get any answers, and he heard about this guru who had all the answers. And so he traveled to this faraway place, and they said, yeah, he lives way up high. You have to climb up this mountain to get there. And he travels, and he climbs up this mountain, and it's you know, he's got down to his last scrap of food, and he's exhausted, and he's tired, and he sees the guru at the top of the mountain, and he says, oh, guru, please tell me, what is the meaning of life? And the guru looks at him and says, life is a fountain. And the man says, wait a second. Hang on. I just traveled the world and sold all my stuff and came here. I'm exhausted. I'm at my wit's end. And you're going to tell me that the answer to all this is that life is a fountain? And the guru looked at him and said, life is not a fountain? So that's a joke I used to tell a lot when I was a teenager. I thought that was hilarious. I thought that was just, you know, that was the first Shaggy Dog joke I ever heard, and I just took it and ran with it. It was a lot longer when I told it back then, too. And I kind of come back to that. That punchline is sort of my spiritual journey. You know, take it or leave it. I grew up at Mainline Unitarian Church in Devon, just down the road. And I had a wonderful, wonderful UU upbringing. That church was like a house, because it was a house. It used to be someone's house, and it was beautiful. It was such a home. There were banisters and windows, and the coffee hour was a ballroom that the previous owner had built for his debutante daughter on her 16th birthday. It was this beautiful room with chandeliers and a hardwood floor. You just wanted to waltz in there. It was a wonderful, special place. And church to me was Sunday school, and that was a huge part of my life. We were school year Unitarians, so it was just September to June. We took the summers off. Church for me was donuts and candles and sharing and making art and donuts. And talking about feelings and feeling really safe and loved and cared for. It was about learning the world's religions. It was about singing. And it was about donuts. There was a lot of donuts. All my memories have this powdered, sugared smell to them. I loved going to church there. Karen Snow was my first Pam Baxter. She was a lovely, lovely woman who was my great guide as a young UU. And when she left, guess who took over? Kate Rohde. And I fell in love with Kate Rohde. I adored her. And when I heard she was leaving to come here, I was so mad. I was so mad. I was about 9, and I was pissed. But you guys got a good one. She was awesome. So I had I have really good feelings about my UU roots. But I had these other experiences that happened when I was young that were pretty formative. When I was in fourth grade, I had this friend named Ruth, and I just thought Ruth was, I think I was in love with Ruth, too. I loved her. She had this shiny black hair and these dark eyes, and she was sort of mysterious, and maybe she was Native American, but maybe she wasn't. But that was interesting, too, and she had a whole bunch of brothers and sisters, and she went to this church down the way on Backton Hill Road, or near Backton Hill Road, and she really loved her church. And so in this bid to sort of impress Ruth and become closer with her, I said, well, I'll go to Bible school with you. My parents were like, okay, whatever. So I signed up. I went to Bible school. My parents were pretty supportive about it. They drove me there every Wednesday night. I was there for 3 hours every Wednesday night. And boy, that was work. That was a lot of Bible. That was Bible school to the extreme. It was 3 hours of reading Bible stories and coloring Bible pictures and doing Bible find a words and singing Bible songs, a lot of Jesus, whole lot of Jesus. And I was feeling pretty good about it. I felt like this was bringing me closer to Ruth, and that was what I wanted. And I felt like it was I was learning a lot about this Bible that I'd heard a lot about it at the UU church and read some of the stuff, but I was getting this sort of in-depth look of things from another point of view. So things were going pretty well, and it came time for this big ceremony at the end of the, I don't know, it felt like eons that I had been going to Bible school there, but there was this big ceremony where I got saved. And I got my own Bible. It was dedicated to me. I was saved. I was thrilled. I came home. I told my parents about it. They were, you know. So I went back the next week, and, you know, the Bible classes were sort of over then, and then the real stuff started happening. And I had a couple questions about this being saved thing, because it was clear to me that because I was saved and I had accepted Jesus Christ as my personal Savior, it was clear to me that I was going to go to heaven. When I died, heaven was my guarantee. I'd done the homework, and that was my reward. And but I kind of thought, well, wait a second. But my mom and dad aren't saved. They're not totally down with this thing. So if I'm saved and they're not saved, then when I die and go to heaven, they won't be there because they're going to be in hell because they didn't get saved, right? So how is that heaven for me if they aren't there, right? So I couldn't figure out that balance. So I asked what I could do about this and what the answer was. And the answer was, you need to go save your parents. And if you ever met my parents, you would know, even as a fourth grader, that was not going to happen. Yeah. So I talked this through with my parents. I really talked this paradigm through, this fallacy, this paradox that I couldn't make sense of. And they were really supportive about it, and they really agreed that I was not going to be able to save them, and they were okay with that, and so I should be okay with that. And my mom asked me, well, Monica, do you believe in all the stuff that you agreed to when you were saved? And I said, well, kind of, yeah. My mom said, well, why did you agree to be saved if you were not really sure? And I said, well, just in case. You know, just in case. That just in case story has been told practically at every Easter, I think, ever. It's one of those old stories of, oh, when Monica got saved. There's another one. I was very intensely curious when I was about 12. You know, so I went back to my UU roots, and I kind of left being saved alone for a while. And but my curiosity was still there. And the questions that I had were answered in a way at my UU church that felt like really good answers that I could. They made sense to me, and they were. It was a safer. It was a place where things weren't scary, and religion wasn't scary, and there was no complete paradox happening that everybody was buying into. It was, and if there was a paradox, we could be with it. So things kind of went. I went back to church, and everything was pretty cool. I did stay pretty curious, though. In fact, there's the other big family story about when I went to visit my relatives in Chicago, and I took communion. Yeah, you're not supposed to do that. Really not supposed to do that. My uncle was so furious. He cursed me out like no Catholic I have ever met in my life. I had defiled his church, and I had done something horribly, horribly wrong. My whole trip to Chicago is just about that moment of curiosity where I just had to taste what that wafer tasted like, and boy, did I pay for it. Oh, I paid for it in spades. Things at MLUC, Mainline Church, were wonderful until Martin Luther King Day of 1989, I believe it was. We got a phone call at about 6 in the morning, and my dad and me drove to church, and it was on fire. It was smoke everywhere. It was a terribly sad day. The minister at that time lived on the campus of the church in an old colonial house, and he and his family were out there, and we were kind of wringing our hands and saving what we could out of the parts of the building that weren't actively on fire. We did that until the fire officer said, "No, you can't do that. You actually got to get out of there." And the minister Brad was standing there, and no less than 6 different people approached Brad that morning, saying, "Oh, Brad, I'm sorry. I was the last person out of the church last night. I left the coffee maker on, and I burned the church down. I'm so sorry." 6 different people had 6 different reasons why they were the last one out and burned down the church. It turned out it was just a terrible accident. Thank goodness nobody was in the church at the time. It was a faulty wire that smoldered until the church almost kind of didn't quite blow up, but it was pretty close. It was a big explosion. So I thought, and I remember very clearly thinking that day, well, that's it. They don't have a church anymore, and I'm probably not going to go here anymore. And I don't know, that was what my brain, my heart told me. And the opposite happened. Within 2 hours of the church burning down, we had an offer from another church down the street that we could come and meet there. And my youth group, who it had been sort of a straggly group of like maybe 8 or 9 of us who'd show up kind of half-heartedly here and there and eat donuts, that group grew to the size of almost 20 kids who came every Sunday, and we met at people's houses. And we became one of the strongest youth groups that church has ever seen. It was an amazing experience. And for me, it was super awesome because those young religious Unitarians, the YRUU group, we were from all different schools. We didn't all go to the same school. We weren't from the same place necessarily. We were from the same area. But it was a place where I could not be who I was at school. I could be who I was at church. And not that those are different people, but it was a nice place to try on some different ideas and be myself in different ways and see how others responded. And it was a really, really formative, amazing experience for me as an adolescent. So then I went to college. And then I finished college and became a grown-up, kind of. And during those years, I did go to church. I went to the Church of St. Mattress on Sunday mornings. It's a lot of sleeping in. And I really kind of, I didn't really go to church. I learned a lot, and when I as was at college, I often knew more about world religions than other people knew about their own religions. I lived in Ireland for a year where I would go to Mass once in a while just because it was so neat to hear it in Latin. I traveled to Korea where I met and meditated with some Buddhist monks who are some of the most amazing people in the whole world. I've been to many Seder dinners. I love Seder dinners with the egg and the bitter herbs and the ceremony of it all. But nothing really took. I just sort of would wander into a UU church here and there and sort of get my bearings and then keep going on in my life. And then I became a parent, and I realized the gift that my parents gave to me of learning who I was and learning so much more about other religions in the world so that I could make my own decisions for myself. That freedom and that safety was so valuable to me that I wanted to give that gift to my kids. Now, I have 2 kids, and you can guess which one is which, but one of them is full of questions and curiosity. She is the kind of child who will completely take communion at some point in her life. I guarantee you, she will not be able to resist the "what does that wafer taste like?" And then when we talked about it kind of recently, she brought up that's kind of like a vampire thing with the communion, you know. And I was like, let's talk about that later, you know. Yeah, there's that. And I have the other kid who, age 3, she was an atheist. There is no God. Age 3, I didn't know what to do with myself, and boy, it made for some sticky times at Calvary Lutheran preschool. This is a kid who does not believe in God, but she's positive about Santa Claus. So, you know. So that really brought me back to church, was knowing that I wanted to give the gift of world religion knowledge and knowing yourself and feeling good about yourself at church and not feeling like church is a place where that's scary or that makes you believe in things you're not sure about, or doesn't encourage you to ask questions, or when you do ask questions, you don't like the answers, or I really valued what I had for myself. Now, if you really need to press me for what I really, really believe, and you don't, but I pressed myself with this spiritual journey talk. An interesting thing happened last summer. I'd moved house. It was a very stressful move. It was very, all moves are stressful, but this move was particularly stressful. It happened in a hurry. It was just a lot of stuff happening at once, and we'd moved house, and I had just done the last load of stuff, and I came home, and I was dirty. I'd moved all the plants, and I was dirty, and I needed a shower. I took a shower. I had a big chicken dinner that my husband made for me, and had a glass of wine, and I thought, I'm not feeling so good. I'm going to go to bed with the kids. So I put the kids to bed, went to bed myself, and I laid in bed, and I had a lot going on in my head, and started to feel a little sick. So I went to the bathroom, and I started to feel pretty sick, and it's now like 11 o'clock at night, 12 o'clock at night, and I got sick, and now 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm still getting sick. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm thinking, oh, God, this is food poisoning, because I feel terrible, and I better make room in here, because everyone else is going to be crowding in here doing the same thing I'm doing in just a few minutes, and who's going to stand in the bathtub and do this, because this is awful, you know? I was very sick, and I get worse. It doesn't get, the more sick I get, the sicker I get, the worse I feel instead of better. You know, I didn't get that respite at all. And it gets to like 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, and I'm laying on the bathroom floor, and it hurts so, my stomach hurts so bad. And I start just moaning and saying, oh, Jesus. Oh, Jesus. Please make this stop. Please, like, God, please make this stop. I start calling on Jesus. I had a Jesus moment. And I'm calling on Jesus, and I'm on the floor, and I'm literally saying, I will do anything. God, Jesus, if you make this stop, just please make this stop. Jesus, please, I will do anything. I will do anything you need me to do. And it was at that moment that I realized that I was so sick, it was time to go to the hospital, because I was calling on Jesus. So I said to my husband, let's go to the hospital. We went to the hospital. I had a nearly burst appendix, and it hurt here. Apparently that can happen. It hurt here until it hurt here, and then it hurt there a lot. So I made a couple promises that night in my head and in my heart, and I didn't really keep them. I didn't go back to Jesus. I didn't go back to my Christian fourth grade roots. I think in that moment of being so scared and in such pain, I needed something to hold on to. So I tell you that because here's what it really boils down to for me. Deep down in my heart, in my soul of souls, deep down in my everlasting, ever-loving soul, I'm an atheist. I am. I kind of always have been. And I know that that's a contradiction. You know, it's like life is a fountain. Life is not a fountain. I'm okay with that contradiction. I'm okay with believing in my soul and also believing that I'm an atheist. And I'm open to other ideas, but I've made peace with that part of who I am. I believe in humanity. I believe in the good of humanity. I believe in the power of people to make the world a better place. I cry when I hear people sing. I cry when I hear people speak their hearts. I lose it when I watch people dance. When I go to a stadium to go watch like John Mellencamp, I cry because I love that so many people are doing one thing together. That is what it's all about for me. I find God in poetry. I find God in music and nature and in connecting with the world around me because this is what I know and this is who I am. So when I need a little religion, I keep coming back to this one poem that I won't read all of it to you, but I'll just read you the last little bit. I encourage you to seek it out if you haven't made it part of your heart. But Mary Oliver wrote this poem, The Summer Day. And I'll conclude with this. And again, this is just the very end of it. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made this grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. This one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down in the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? I told you I cry at poetry. Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Thank you.
It's a tough act to follow. So I'm Chris Heisen, and I'd like to talk about my spiritual journey, my spiritual path, and I think to talk about mine, I actually want to step back in time and start with my parents. Both of my parents were raised Presbyterian. As far as I know, they both went to church every single Sunday until going to college, and then I don't think anything. I don't recall religion ever coming up once in discussion or in certainly in attendance for the earliest part of my life. Somewhere around second or third grade, I think my mother decided this kid should learn something about religion. So when I say we, I mean my mom and I, started going to the Congregational Church in the middle of our town. It was one of those New England churches, big white church with a steeple. And the reason that she picked that church, I think, was geographic convenience. I think she knew, well, I'm not a Catholic, so there was a Catholic church in the middle of the town, and also this one, so she picked this one. And I attended Sunday school there for maybe a year or so, and in that year I learned spectacularly little. The last time I went to church, actually, in my pre-UCWC days was 30 years ago today. It was Easter 1986. And in that service, they actually did a communion where they passed around these little pieces of bread and like these shot glasses with like a teaspoon of grape juice. And to illustrate how little I had learned, I actually recall leaning over to my mom and saying, "Is this it for the snack?" I don't recall her answer, but it was a nice place to go to this church, but I don't think I actually got anything out of it. And somewhere around third grade, I know I just didn't go anymore, and Mom didn't go anymore. I don't know if my younger brother or sister ever actually got to go to church at all. Maybe my mom said, "Well, that didn't work." And then I went through childhood not really thinking about spiritual path. And then as I started to become an adult, in that sort of like 18 to 30 years old, I started to have philosophical, spiritual thoughts. And one of my thoughts was, gosh, religion is scary. I don't know if any of you were ever in this boat, but like walking into a church, I actually felt very uncomfortable. It's like, well, I'm walking into this church and I don't believe what all these other people believe, so I'm not sure if I should be here. It felt a little bit disingenuous. And the fancier the church, the less comfortable it was. Like going into a cathedral, it's like, gosh, maybe I'll just wait outside while the other people go in. There were occasions to go to such churches. You know, there were weddings, funerals, bar mitzvahs, you name it. But anyway, as an adult, I started to think about things. And I found that, that I best thought about things in a nature setting. Going out in the woods, I could really like be there with my thoughts in a big field, even in my own backyard. My wife will tell you I'm partial to swamps. A swamp is just like there's all this interesting life and stuff going on in a swamp. I could really think about things. I'd like to share like one specific evening though. It was at the summer camp that I was working at. And we routinely had nights off, and on my nights off, often I would just go to this, there was this park next to the camp, a big open field. Of course, it's after dark, so no one's there. Maybe some teenagers making out, but usually nobody there. And I would like lie there in the field to look up at the stars. And one night while I was doing this, I just got really worried. I was looking out at all these stars, and I'm thinking, I can see thousands of stars, but I'm aware that there are millions and billions more out there. My heart started beating fast. I'm like, am I this insignificant? There's all this out there, and I'm just this little guy looking out at all of it. And then I realized, when I look up at the stars, I see constellations. And I don't just see like Orion's Belt and the Big Dipper. I see other constellations that only I can see. So like, I'm not insignificant. I'm the only one that knows what some of these things look like because I'm the only one who's ever seen it. And it made me feel much better about myself. But then just when I was kind of feeling like everything is okay, I looked down and I saw the grass and I saw the dew on the grass. And I was thinking, you know, if I just put my foot right there, I can fundamentally rearrange all of that dew, all of those little droplets and all of those blades of grass. They can be bent and smushed and spread all over the place. And I started to worry then that I was too significant. this is like a spiritual philosophical problem. It's like, is it is or is it not, right? I had both. But then I started to think about this, and I realized as I looked down at this grass and I looked a little bit closer that there were countless little dewdrops just in a couple square feet of grass. All these little dewdrops. It was kind of like looking back up at the stars again, because there was so much of this in the small version. And then I felt better again because I said, thank goodness I'm not too significant. I have a place in the universe, and this is good stuff. And I've had other experiences like that, but that was one night where I was like, wow, I'm starting to get it. That didn't make me any more comfortable with religion as a thing. Still, you know, going into church, I'm worried that I am, you know, violating some rule. I don't think I ever took communion in a way that I'd be in trouble. But then coming here was something that happened many years later. How old was I? 36 years old, I think, when I came in the door here for the first time. My wife, Sarah, a few times throughout our relationship had said, I'd like to go to church. I think one time we even drove out to a church and like kind of looked at it. And then, like, and I don't think anybody was there, and then we walked away, and it was like, okay. It was motivation from Sarah occasionally saying, maybe we should go to church, plus a funny situation with our son, Nate, where we were playing 20 questions, and I think the answer was a hobbit. No? A minotaur? Okay. It was some mythological creature, and we said it was the clue was it's mythological and like nobody would really believe in it unless they were crazy. And he said, is it Jesus? Well, and while I'm not a believer in the divinity of Jesus, if you go around saying Jesus, only crazy people believe in Jesus, you're in big trouble in this country. Like that's, but we said, you know what? A little bit of religious education will go a long way. So, between Sarah telling me like, we should try this, and our children obviously needing something. I said, okay, you know what? I'll show up. I'll come in the door. I'll do this thing. And I said, but mark my words, I'm not sure I used that phrase, but I said, if I ever have something better to do on a Sunday morning than this, I'm going to be doing it. And I think it's testament to how great this all is for me. I think, if I calculate right, of the last 82 Sundays, I've been here 73 of them. So that's, yeah, I feel pretty good about this. So it wasn't easy to come here, but now that I'm here, I'm sold. It's like religion without all the pieces of religion that I made me feel really weird walking in. So since I've been here, I've learned more about religion. Those things that I didn't learn in Sunday school back when, I had the chance as a child. I'm learning that stuff. I feel like I can actually walk into any church now. So if I have a friend who's getting married in a cathedral, I can like walk in there and be okay with that now. I don't have to be scared anymore. And lastly, this gives me an opportunity to continue my internal spiritual growth, but also a little bit more of the external. Like, you're all here, and it's all part of the deal. So I really appreciate that, and I want to thank you for being part of the journey as I keep going.
Following a couple of comedians. Y'all should have put me first. First, I want to explain about this in case anybody's wondering. I broke a little bone at the bottom of my thumb. It's okay. I'm really glad it wasn't my third finger. Because I can still play, so that's a good thing. Okay, so happy Easter. Who went to Sunday morning like sunrise services when they were a kid? Anybody? Anybody? Yeah, I remember the town I grew up near, Vicksburg, Mississippi. We would go to Fort Hill. Has anybody's ever been to the Civil War battlefield there in Vicksburg? I grew up on that land, actually. And we would go, it was a community service at the top of Fort Hill, and we'd go see the sunrise. And I've got a lot of good memories from that. But today, what a privilege it is for me to be asked to do this. A privilege both in a good sense and in the kind of the recently coined white privilege sense. There's a little bit of I feel I'm privileged to be able to do this because so many people are born into poverty or today refugees. There's so many people like that who don't have enough to eat, so much less, have the luxury of being able to search for something that they believe in. But so I feel very fortunate both that I was asked to do this and that I've had that circumstance I was born into. I grew up in rural Mississippi on a farm, and it was just a perfect surrounding for kids. I had three brothers. I'm one of four, the youngest of four siblings. And it developed a very deep attachment to the natural world very early on. That's always been pretty much it for me, is just being outdoors. We had no air conditioning, so there was always the sound of bugs and birds in the windows being open. I grew up in the Methodist Church in Vicksburg. My parents took us there every week. And a favorite story, a family story, was the day that I was baptized as a baby. I don't remember it. When my mother handed me over to the minister, I threw up all over him. So I must have been skeptical of something, even at that point. But I did grow up in the church, obediently went to Sunday school, learned all the Bible books, memorized all those and won little awards. And everything went pretty well until I was about 13. I don't know really what happened when I was 13, but then the questions started. Primarily, why did I have to dress up to go to church? It's kind of ironic I wore a dress today, but why couldn't I wear jeans? Didn't God accept me as I was, no matter what I looked like? Well, that particular question earned a slap across the face from my father, so I learned not to ask any more questions like that from him. A pivotal point in my religious development was in our youth group. I was probably 15, and I was asking so many questions, and probably knowing my sarcasm at times, I was asking them in a manner that I was asked to leave the group permanently. And I never did tell my parents that. I my brother and I would just get dropped off at church. My brother, a year and a half older than me, whatever he did, I did. And so we would go smoke cigarettes and whatever we could find to get into. And then when my parents would pick us up, we would be that back there obediently as if we'd been to the youth group. But growing up in the Deep South in the 60s, I was in one of the very first fully integrated classes in my elementary school. And my mother worked at that school. She was a secretary. From my mother, I learned early on that blacks were little more than animals and that they could never be expected to work or be anywhere as good as us whites. And that was just a pervasive message throughout my childhood. She was descended from slave owners, and she had been taught early on to hate. So, of course, that's what she taught us kids. My father, who had fought in the Pacific during World War II, was a little bit more worldly. He had experienced a little bit more. But I often wonder about my mother. You know, I've since forgiven her. She's been dead a few years. I think she did the best she could. This is what she had been taught. But I wonder, you know, why did I turn away from that faith? And I think that seeing that hypocrisy was a really important factor for me. Just, you know, hearing her go to church and watching her, you know, be one person there in church and then this a totally different person at home. There was a black family that lived in the woods very close to us, and they were descended from slaves and sharecroppers. They lived in a little shack that had no running water, no electricity, and this was even in the early 70s. These people were living, they had numerous children. A lot of the kids were my age, so my brother and I naturally gravitated towards there to play with the kids. And once my parents found out, we were strictly forbidden to go over there. But we would still sneak over in the woods and play with them often. My older brother and sister are good Christians and chose that path. And there's always a lot of tension when I go home because they know that I'm not a believer like that. In a way, I wish I could be, you know, especially as my parents got older and the assurance and confidence they got from knowing that they were near heaven and, you know, that faith. But it's just something I've never been able to embrace. I went to undergraduate school at Delta State University in North Mississippi, where I attended the same college Monica did, the St. Matris College, right? And later went to grad school at Florida State in Tallahassee. And it was there that I met my first husband, who was a Jewish man, and he was studying music therapy. He was a cellist. So he and I decided that if we were to have children, we would raise them in the Jewish faith tradition. My mother was appalled, not surprisingly. She had taught me that the Jews had killed Jesus. My father, a man of few words, said that the most important thing was just that we go. If we joined something, we just needed to be there. So he was supportive. During my first few visits to the Reform synagogue we attended, the very first thing that got me was the music. All the minor melodies, the haunting melodies. And I really got hooked by the music, I believe. So I was mesmerized. We later had two sons. They both had bar mitzvahs, grew up in Temple. We were very active there. And as they began to learn more about Judaism, I got very interested in it. So I studied to convert. So over a year, I went for every week to meet with the rabbi to study for a conversion ceremony. But when the time came to choose the date for the ceremony, I couldn't do it. It just didn't feel right. One of the biggest blocks for me was the term the chosen people. I couldn't understand why one group of people would be chosen over another group of people. So a few years prior to starting our family, when we lived in Sarasota, Florida, a pianist job came open at the church, the Unitarian Church in Sarasota, and I'd heard about UUism. When I was a young adult, I had a friend in Vicksburg who was a UU. She had to drive 60 miles to the nearest church. And then my elementary music teacher was a Universalist. So I'd heard about it, but I hadn't really done much research. But the very first time I walked into the church in Sarasota, I knew that this was home. This was the place I needed to be. And I later took a job as the music director at the Tallahassee Church, where I was there for 17 years before I moved here. So now that you know a little bit about my background, I'd just like to share a few realizations that I've come to over the years. Not surprisingly, the first is that music and spirituality are pretty much interchangeable for me. They're the same thing. Most of my transformative moments, whether they've been in a church, in a temple, driving in my car, they have happened when I was listening to or performing music. The lyrics, which used to be of supreme importance to me as a mother of Jewish kids having to sing Christmas carols in public school, that was a big deal then. They're not that big of a deal to me anymore. The words don't matter as much to me. In my work at Lincoln University as staff accompanist, I often travel with the choir to different churches on Sunday mornings. So we frequently go to churches where the choir sings, and the power of the music that I've seen there has been unlike anything I've ever witnessed. And even though I don't really understand the words and the, you know, the underlying reason to sing, it's not that important to me. It's just the music is so powerful, it moves me. The second big truth for me is that it's important to give thanks every second I'm alive. Every second. Of course, I don't do it all the time, but I try. I used to be stuck here about giving thanks. Who or what was I giving thanks to? I don't have a traditional view of God. I remember reading a book when I was studying to convert to Judaism called God is a Verb. That intrigued me, this assigning of a different meaning to that ultimate noun. I have come to be at complete peace with this idea of gratitude for its own sake. It's not important to me that there's a receiver or not for my thanks. I only give it. And finally, I worship best outside, like Chris. In the woods, the desert, mountains, the swamp, the beach, or even on our small patio, that's where I feel at peace. It doesn't matter so much where I am, just that I'm outside. I feel my heart rate slow, my breathing deepens, and my head clears. So to all of you, my fellow travelers, I'd like to express my thanks. May we all find peace as we search for wisdom together.
Sermon podcasts are recorded live during Sunday services at the Unitarian Congregation of Westchester, Pennsylvania. The Unitarian Congregation of Westchester is a member congregation of the Unitarian Universalist Association. To sign up for our email newsletter, go to connect.ucwc.org.